Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict addresses members of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, urging them to pursue the ecumenical journey with passion. We hear from the Anglican leader, Archbishop Rowan Williams, and Orthodox Metropolitan John Zizoulas, who were attending a special 50th anniversary celebration of that Pontifical Council. And meeting God in friend and stranger, we take a look at how the recent document of the bishops of England and Wales has been encouraging closer cooperation between members of different faith communities. The legacy of the past half century of dialogue between the different Christian denominations and the future direction of the ecumenical journey were under the spotlight here in the Vatican this week as the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity marked its 50th anniversary. On Thursday, Pope Benedict met with members of the council who've been holding their plenary assembly all week on the theme of a new phase of the ecumenical dialogue.
Nel corso di 50 anni è stata percorsa molta strada.
In his address, the Pope said the ecumenical journey has come a long way over the past 50 years, building up new understanding and respect between the different churches and communities, overcoming historical prejudices, advancing the theological dialogue, but also that of charity and cooperation on issues including the defence of life, the promotion of justice, care of the environment, and common biblical translations.
Oggi alcuni pensano che tale cammino, specie in Occidente, abbia perso il suo slancio.
The Pope noted that many in the Western churches feel the ecumenical journey has now lost its impetus. Thus, there is an urgent need to form new generations and revive the enthusiasm necessary to tackle the challenges of further fragmentation and new ethical questions.
Anche con le chiese ortodosse e le antiche chiese orientali, con le quali esistono strettissimi legami, la Chiesa Cattolica prosegue con passione il dialogo.
Also in the dialogue with the Orthodox and Oriental churches, the Pope said the Catholic Church pursues this journey with passion, including the crucial question of the role of the Bishop of Rome.
Cari amici, pur in presenza di nuove situazioni problematiche e di punti difficili per il dialogo, la meta del cammino ecumenico rimane immutata.
Pope Benedict stressed that even when faced with new and difficult situations, the goal of the ecumenical journey must remain unchanged, along with our firm commitment to it. Not in terms of political negotiations or skilled mediation, which sooner or later must reach a compromise acceptable to all sides, but rather in the twofold action of theological research and prayer, which remains, above all, at the heart of our whole journey. Also on Thursday, Pope Benedict met privately with the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, and the Orthodox Metropolitan of Pergamon, John Zizoulas. Both leaders had joined past and present members of the Pontifical Council for a celebration on Wednesday evening, recalling the founding of the Secretariat by Pope John XXIII in 1960 in preparation for the Second Vatican Council.
We have already been reminded this afternoon that the calling of the Pontifical Council is not primarily one of ecclesiastical diplomacy. The Council has always been, and it still is, very valuably, a place where the very idea of unity can be thought about.
Drawing inspiration from New Testament texts, Dr. Williams spoke of the three dimensions of unity with Christ, with each other, and with the apostolic tradition, which can underpin this next phase of the ecumenical dialogue. Urging his listeners not to lose sight of what he called the Ut Unum Sint agenda, he called for shared reflection on the Lord's Prayer, the Creed, and above all on Eucharistic theology, which, he said, has worn thin in many Christian communities today.
I was suggesting, just as a almost flying a kite sort of idea, that maybe the Pontifical Council should get a working group together from across a number of historic churches and newer churches, Pentecostal and Evangelical, to talk about the Eucharist and the Church. Because there's a great strand of Christian identity that doesn't seem to think the Eucharist is as basic as many of us do.
Speaking to me after his presentation, Archbishop Williams tackled some of the more thorny issues on the road to Christian unity, but he began by sharing with me his views on the fruits of Pope Benedict's recent pastoral visit to Britain. Archbishop Rowan Williams, it's just a couple of months since our last meeting in Westminster Abbey during Pope Benedict's visit to Britain. Is it possible, first of all, do you think, to talk in any way about the fruits of that visit, particularly from an ecumenical perspective?
I think the ecumenical fruits have actually been very powerful. A couple of weeks after the visit, Archbishop Vincent Nichols and myself were with others at a meeting of the black majority churches and their leaders in London. And a lot of the black-led, black-majority Pentecostal churches were saying how much they'd felt the Pope's visit had affirmed them, how they felt it had been deeply significant for Christians throughout the country. And I think that has continued to be a very general feeling. The feeling, as I think I said when we spoke last, that a lot of ordinary people had come out on the streets for their faith, had shown that they weren't threatening, that they were neighbours. So that's carried on. I think it's certainly given to Archbishop Vincent and myself a very strong sense of the need to work on building on what we already have, the good relations between our bishops and so forth. So I think the fruits continue to be very positive.
So they should really kick-start, in fact, the next round of ARCHIC, which starts up soon.
Well, I hear reports of good things on that front, and I do feel very optimistic about that.
You're here, of course, marking the 50th anniversary of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity during a plenary entitled Towards a New Phase of Ecumenical Dialogue. To most people, this would seem a much harder, much more uncertain phase than the one that began 50 years ago. What are your hopes for it?
Well, first of all, I think that any great new enterprise begins with massive hope and positive feeling, and then, of course, discovers reality. As Dr. Johnson said, reality keeps breaking in, and we can't avoid that. So I'm not entirely surprised that 50 years on it doesn't feel quite so sunny. But what we have done, I think, is to quarry further and further about the meanings of the baptism we share. And certainly in the plans that the Pontifical Council has for the future, they speak about more work on that, more work about how we pray the Lord's Prayer together. What do we mean when we pray together the prayer of Jesus Christ? Because that says something about the baptism we share, and it also says something about what we hope for.
You're talking about the Pontifical Council as a space where the idea, a vision for unity can really be discussed, and yet there are many who are increasingly concerned about the work of the Council for Unity coming increasingly under the jurisdiction of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith as we explore what ecclesiology really means, what church really means. How much of this is a concern to you too?
Well, I can't comment on, you know, internal Vatican issues, but I do share a concern that the Pontifical Council should retain a real theological strand to its work. And, of course, that means that the CDF is going to take an interest, but I hope that there will continue to be that space, which I mentioned, for thinking about unity. It's too easy sometimes to believe we know what unity is bound to mean. If we look at both history and theology, it's a lot more varied, and we need to be honest about that.
There is a lot of talk about what is the goal today, that many in the Protestant world have settled for a kind of unity and diversity. What do you, perhaps, if you could try and define that goal as you see it today?
I think it's perfectly proper to think of our goal as unity and diversity, but not a diversity of an endless multiplication of institutions. I still think we have to pray for visible sacramental communion, the recognition of ministries, the ability to function as intelligibly one body across the globe. That's what we must pray for, I think.
You also say it's important not to lose sight of the vision contained in Ut Unum Sint. Can you tell us more what you mean by that?
The great thing about Ut Unum Sint was that it was the Bishop of Rome asking other Christians, what service should this ministry, this Petrine ministry, be offering to the whole Christian world? Now, that's a very good question, and I don't think we've begun to get to the bottom of it, because it is saying, in effect, the ministry of the See of Rome is not simply, as some people think, a top-downwards executive magisterial authority. It's also a ministry of universal service, universal drawing together of believers. So what does that actually mean concretely? If it doesn't mean quite the way the papacy has evolved in the last few centuries, what then? I think that's a very challenging, very fruitful area.
Another very challenging area, of course, is that of the ordinariate. Now, you've repeatedly said to me, it's not important, it doesn't affect the dialogue, and yet I'm increasingly seeing people here in Rome talking about it as a very, as the Pope said, prophetic gesture, which has helped us to understand better who we are and where we are going together.
Well, I think if the ordinariate helps people value something of the Anglican legacy, the Anglican patrimony, as it's called, well and good. I'm happy to praise God for that. When I say it doesn't upset our relationships, I think what I mean is primarily that I don't see it as an aggressive act. I don't see it as meant to destabilize the relation of the churches. And again, as I've said before, it remains to be seen just how large a movement we're talking about. And I remain skeptical about some of the bigger claims that are made. But prophetic, maybe yes, in the sense that here is the Roman Catholic Church saying there are ways of being a Christian even in the Western Church which are not restricted just by historic Roman Catholic identity. And that's something we can talk about.
What was your reaction to, we've seen the first five bishops departing, what was your reaction and how difficult is it going to be? I see talk of 50 priests expected to join them. How much is this going to affect the actual organisation of the Church of England?
Well, obviously my reaction to the resignations is one of regret. But as I said at the time, regret and respect. I know the sort of considerations that they've been through, and particularly with the two who were my suffragans. We've talked about it. We've worked through it as best we can. We've parted with prayers and blessings. So there's no ill feeling there. I think the challenge is going to come in sorting out what is really going to be possible for shared use of churches, working out perhaps some of the challenges on how we, as Anglicans, so to speak, recommend people, what information the Roman Catholic Church wants from us, how we organise that and make sure that we have a good and workable system. And also, of course, there will be at least some parishes which will now be without priests, and so we have a practical challenge here and there to supply.
Paradoxically, it makes it easier, perhaps, to identify who is speaking for the Church of England. One of the problems that Rome has been saying recently is that it's hard to identify exactly who is speaking for the Church of England. And with the loss of this perhaps more traditionalist voice, does that make it easier in a way?
It's an interesting question. I wish you were right about that. I'm not sure it does quite sort that, because, of course, there are still a great many Anglicans in the Church of England who would call themselves traditionalist, who have no intention of jumping ship at this point, who are at the moment in considerable confusion and distress, some of them, wondering what the Church of England can do for them. But they don't necessarily think that if the Church of England isn't working for them, then the only option is Rome. So there's a great deal of work that goes on there. So I'd simply question whether it means the traditional voice has abandoned the Church of England. No, I don't think it has. But if the Roman Catholic Church is looking for who speaks for the Church of England, well, it is, of course, in the bishops in synod in the long run.
Just finally, a question. Here in the West, we discuss these differences in a very comfortable setting, and yet you recently spent a fortnight in India, didn't you, where Christians of so many different denominations are facing the most terrible forms of persecution. Should we not perhaps be looking to some of these very dramatic situations for an impetus for the next 50 years of ecumenical dialogue?
I couldn't agree more. I think Christians are drawn closer together than in any other circumstances when they face pressure and persecution in Iraq, in Pakistan, in Indonesia, and indeed in Orissa or Rajasthan. Christians under pressure don't have the luxury of waiting to stand together until they've sorted everything out.
You heard some of the stories of Christians in Orissa, didn't you?
I met firsthand with a number of people who'd been involved the receiving end of violence. I listened to a woman who'd seen her husband tortured to death in front of her for refusing to abandon his Christian faith. That's simply a moment where you realise what the basic truths and the most important things are.
Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury there, Dr. Rowan Williams. Alongside past and current presidents of the Pontifical Council, Cardinal Walter Kasper and Cardinal-elect Kurt Koch, the other key speaker at the 50th anniversary celebrations was the renowned Orthodox Metropolitan John Zizioulas of Pergamon, who talked about past achievements of the Catholic Orthodox dialogue and the need to keep its ultimate goal clearly in mind. So you're here taking part in this event commemorating 50 years of the Council for Christian Unity as it enters perhaps a new phase of the dialogue. What do you see, first of all, as the most important fruits of the past 50 years, the greatest achievement of this Council?
Well, of course, the first and most important fruit is the relationships of love and respect that have been cultivated by the Council, particularly between Catholics and Orthodox, because, as you know, in the past, in the second millennium, there have been many, I would say, even conflicts between Orthodox and Catholics. And so this change, this reversal of the atmosphere, change of the atmosphere, is, I think, the most important thing. Then, I think, for me as a theologian, and I think for the Church as a whole, the theological dialogue has been a real blessing, a fruit of the work of the Pontifical Council. Of course, in cooperation with the Orthodox, but the people that started the dialogue, like Cardinal Willebrands, Bishop Dupré, Eleftherio Fortino, and so on, they were so enthusiastic about it that we miss them very much. I wish they were still here. So it was a period really of enthusiasm, of great expectations when we started the dialogue. I think the momentum continues. The dialogue is still, in spite of the difficulties, of course, still in the center of our relations, the Roman Catholic and Orthodox relations. And I believe that there is a future in the dialogue.
There are still many, though, in the Orthodox world who are very sceptical, who see the Council and the dialogue as still a kind of attempt to bring the Orthodox world under Rome's authority.
Well, this is why I chose to speak about that in my address tonight, because I think it's a misunderstanding. I mean, the opposition to the theological dialogue and to these contacts between Catholics and Orthodox, I think, is rooted in this fear, which is totally unjustifiable now after Vatican II. That's why I quoted from Vatican II clear statements that make this fear unjustifiable. I think we have to stress this point, and those, of course, of goodwill, they will take it into consideration. There are those who will not be persuaded, no matter what.
The current discussions are focusing very much on the question of primacy, how it was exercised before the Great Schism. What are your hopes? How much hope can we have that an agreement will be reached in this very difficult area?
Well, the subject is very difficult, but in spite of that, I have reasons to be optimistic, because in Ravenna we managed to agree on two fundamental points about primacy. A, that primacy at the universal level is necessary, it's part of the nature of the Church. And B, that primacy must be exercised in connection with synodality, so that we'll not have a monarchical and absolute authority that would make the Orthodox difficult to accept primacy. So once these two principles are respected, I think the rest is easy to agree on. Because in the first millennium, this is what happened. There was primacy. The Bishop of Rome was the first bishop of all the patriarchs, was the first one, and this was recognized by everybody. But it was also the case in the first millennium that the Pope would not claim jurisdiction over other patriarchates. This developed later in the second millennium, but in the first millennium there was no sense of jurisdiction in any case. So if we take the first millennium as our basis, and that's what also the De Ecumenismo of Vatican II and Pope John Paul II said to Patriarch Demetrios Constantinople, this is the ground on which the Orthodox and the Catholics should unite, the first millennium. Then I think things will become easier to come in agreement between us on the question also of primacy.
Thanks there to the Orthodox Metropolitan John Zizoulas of Pergamon. Meeting God in Friend and Stranger is the name of a comprehensive document about interfaith relations issued by the Catholic bishops of England and Wales in April 2010. It's a lengthy publication setting out the principles of Catholic teaching, plus some interesting practical examples of where interfaith activities are working best in parishes and dioceses around the country.
It's an excellent document, a very straightforward, easy-to-read document, which is still very complex. So it meant just not to sacrifice any of the complex theological context and to still remain readable and accessible.
Katharina Muller is secretary for the Interreligious Relations Committee of the Bishops' Conference.
It's called Meeting God in Friend and Stranger, and it's available for download from our website. It's available from Christian bookshops, from the Catholic Truth Society, and I can very much recommend it. It's written very much with everybody in mind, very much with the option for everyone to study it and learn from the document. And it urges Catholics to enter into interreligious dialogue. And I think that's a very important point to make.
Do you think it has been received in a positive way by people? What reactions have you had so far?
I think it's been received in a very positive manner indeed, and not only by Catholics. I think it's very good for Catholics to have all teaching on interreligious dialogue in one place and to be able to use that in dialogue as well, to say, look, this is our official position. We're not doing this as a hobby, you know, or because we're the funny people who it is important to, but this is the official church line. This is important to all of us. Our bishops are urging us to do that. And also my ecumenical contact, and in fact contacts from other religions. Now obviously it's a document that is aimed at Catholics, so it's not a document that speaks to these contacts so much, but it's been very well received indeed, and I think it inspires other churches and other religions to also make their own position clearer, to come up with similar documents, similar statements, and I think that's a very positive thing actually.
You're right that in the past it was sometimes seen to be very in favour of interfaith dialogue, was sometimes seen as a rather sort of lefty, trendy thing to do, wasn't it? A rather liberal position,
yes,
by those who weren't able to defend perhaps the truths of their own faith.
Very much so, yes. And I think it's very important that the document makes a point that, no, this is not new teaching. This is just a new compilation of teaching that has always been around, and it's always been important to have that dialogue. But this is just a new, just to get it out there again, and to have it all in one place, which I think is very helpful. And I think really, if we take our belief seriously, that we are a church in constant dialogue with our God, and that we have a God who's entered into that very costly dialogue, then if we want to take our own belief seriously, we can not afford not to enter into dialogue with others as well.
As you know, many parish priests will say, yes, that's fine, we get on perfectly nicely with our Jewish and Muslim neighbours, but we're far too busy as it is without embarking on any new initiatives to support this work.
Well, and I'm very aware that people are incredibly busy and that priests are busy and lay people have very busy lives. But I think that dialogue is something that can be shared very easily. And when I'm talking about dialogue, I'm talking about the wider definition that the document also has. So it's not just sitting down together and discussing the finer theological points. You know, it's as easy as having a chat with a Muslim neighbor or extending good wishes to a Jewish friend at a Jewish festival. Or, you know, indeed to share a meal, maybe a Christmas dinner with a family who is not Christian. And that sort of everyday contact can help make excellent progress with dialogue between the religions. So it's not something that should be left to experts. And indeed, the document says that lay people are often very well placed, actually, to enter into that dialogue. So it stresses that responsibility of lay people who are in the world, who have colleagues and friends and neighbours of different faiths, to actually enter into that dialogue.
Do you have any best practice stories, any areas where you really have seen extraordinary results from just this, as you say, very straightforward type of dialogue of daily life?
Well, I think there are a lot of touching stories out there, actually. Just very recently, one of my diocesan coordinators, there's an interreligious coordinator in every diocese, has got Muslim and Catholic women together, and they've shared their stories of praying with the rosary and with the Muslim prayer beads, and it was a very warm, very touching occasion. Also, I know of a Catholic and a Jewish lady, again a coordinator, who struck up a very fast friendship by interreligious dialogue. And I think it's these things that might look fairly small, but that really make a difference to communities and to how people feel about each other, really.
Are you suggesting that women may be leading the way in this field or not?
Well, I think women are still often the people who pick children up from the school gate and, you know, the family managers to an extent. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily a good thing, and I think men are coming into that field as well, but I think at the moment we very much have women as the centre of family still, and you know, they're arranging the play dates for the children and they're picking the children up from school, and they're probably the ones who remember the neighbours' birthdays, you know, and they probably remember the neighbours' festivals as well, you know. So, yeah, I think women are doing fairly well in that field, yeah.
Thanks there to Catharina Muller, Secretary for the Interreligious Relations Committee of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales.
And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at the same time tomorrow if you can, or don't forget you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.